Let's go ahead and take our Bibles and turn to the book of Micah this morning, if you would, please. The book of Micah. We're in the middle of a series on the minor prophets in the Old Testament. And as we've looked at what the prophets are saying in total, the culmination or the accumulation of their message is that they call God's people to enter into the ways of your God. And each of the different prophets have a different theme or variation on that theme. But as they're working through each of their individual books, each of their individual messages, in each of their individual centuries, in each of their different geographical locations, they're basically saying the same thing. Israel, be holy because your God is holy. And if you won't be holy like your God, you will experience the holiness of your God in ways that you are not prepared. So we've looked at the book of Hosea, a love story, but a love story on only one side, as God deals with his people's repeated treachery by targeting their heart. And he uses the illustration of a man and a wife who's unfaithful, and a man who buys her back from her lovers, used and abused, and loves her back to himself, picturing God's love for his people. We've looked at the book of Amos just last week, and we saw that in the book of Amos, God identifies his people's love of luxury, their love of comfort, as a love that they can't afford, loving things that they can see and not loving the one that they cannot see. As we move today to the book of Micah, again an 8th century prophet, what we'll see is that God addresses his people's leadership vacuum by promising them his good shepherd. Micah is where we're at. Let's go ahead and we'll look at chapter 4. Will help us to get oriented with a short passage here. Actually, let's look at verse 12 of the previous chapter. Micah 3, verse 12, therefore, because of you, and you is the leadership of Israel and Judah, primarily Judah, therefore, because of you, leaders, Zion shall be plowed as a field, Jerusalem shall become a heap of ruins, and the mountain of the house, that is, the temple mount, will become a wooded height. But, chapter 4, verse 1, it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains. It shall be lifted up above the hills, and people shall flow to it, and many nations shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And then note the next simple little word. It's a pronoun. It stands in place of a noun. He, that is God himself, will judge between many peoples. He shall decide for strong nations far away. They shall beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. But they shall sit, every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid. For the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken it. The Lord of hosts is an active title for God, the one who's going to make this happen. Verse 5. For all the peoples walk, each in the name of its God. But we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. It's a promise. We will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. Chapter 5. Muster your troops, O daughter of troops. Siege is laid against us. With a rod they strike the judge, the king of Israel, on the cheek. But you, O Bethlehem Ephratah, who are too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me one who is to be ruler in Israel, whose coming forth is from old, from ancient of days. Therefore, He shall give them up until the time when she who is in labor has given birth. Then the rest of his brothers shall return to the people of Israel, and he shall stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. And they shall dwell secure. For now he shall be great to the ends of the earth, and he shall be their peace. Book of Micah, a book of both stark judgment and ravishing beauty as God provides salvation through his king. If you've kept up with any of the Christian video series that are coming up and continue coming out, you'll know that the brothers who've put together a couple of videos in the past were Courageous, Facing the Giants. They put out a new one called Kingdom Men Rising, and it's been out in theaters for a couple weeks. It's now out on DVD. Took some time to just look at the trailer this week. And as I look at the book of Micah, this trailer stuck out to me because of the way it starts. There's a young man who's speaking, and he says this: "Oftentimes growing up in a fatherless home, I didn't know why I was lonely. I didn't know why I was sad. I just knew something was missing." And the storyline and the movie is about kingdom men stepping into place, rising to their positions, to take that role of leadership, calling another generation to follow the God who's worth following, and filling in the gaps that's required in a leaderless world. As we look at the book of Micah, what we're going to see is that there's a leadership crisis. We need to remind ourselves of when Micah is writing his book, his work, when he's performing his ministry. You'll see over here on the map that the top half, the blue half of the map, is the kingdom of Israel. It's a divided kingdom at this point. Israel in the north, the kingdom of Judah in the south. As we've been looking at the prophets of Amos and Hosea, we've seen them working and functioning up in the north. We'll see that Jonah is one who ministers. He's going to minister over in Nineveh as we look at his story next week. But these are prophets in the north. Isaiah and Micah writing still in the 700s, the 8th century, but the 700 AD, are prophets to the south. The book of Isaiah, we call a major prophet because it's bigger, it's major. It takes up a lot of space in your Bible. Not because his message is more major, just because his works are more voluminous than other writers. Micah has sometimes been called the mini Isaiah, for many of their themes are the same, which is obvious for the reason why. They're ministering in the same place at the same time. In fact, if you were to take chapter 2 in the book of Isaiah and look at chapter 4 of the book of Micah, you would see that for four verses, they're almost exactly the same, the exact same wording and everything, exact same sequence and so on, as they echo each other's ministries. This is a time, it's a region where the Assyrian Empire, we saw last week in the book of Amos in particular, where the Assyrian Empire was in decline. Therefore, those that they were oppressing and dominating found some respite, and they found themselves in a period of growth, accentuating their wealth, accentuating their comfort, accentuating their luxury, and taking every opportunity to do it. And so as they'd become accustomed to wealth, as they'd become accustomed to freedoms and growth and comfort, they're taking advantage of others to get what they want so they can have a life of ease. This is the culture, this is the time that Micah is writing. But you'll see that his writings come a little bit after the book of Amos. The Assyrians are slowly in a period not of decline anymore, but slowly on a period of ascendancy. They're rising in strength. They've taken a lull. They've become a world power a full century before this, and their growth has waxed, but only for a little bit as it rises to a new high before being taken over by the Babylonians. But as we come to this book of Micah, what we're going to see is a call for God's people to learn to follow the one who will never lead them astray. In the middle of their wealth, in the middle of their luxury, Amos was sent up to the north. A kingdom that from the very beginning had golden calves that they named after the name of the God of Israel. In fact, some of the artifacts that have been found in the region refer to the God of that northern region along with his Asherah, saying that Yahweh had taken a consort, a female god, as his bride, and they would worship both Yahweh and his Asherah, worshiping the gods of the people and the God of Israel in a mixed syncretic way. And so, as you look at what's been happening up in the north, they're farther ahead and they're running away from God. But their younger sister Judah is not far behind. And so they follow in the steps. In fact, you're in Micah. Go ahead, go to chapter 6, verse 16. Micah is doing his ministry within the confines of Judah in particular, with some references to Samaria. But as he's working and operating within the realms of Judah, primarily the city of Jerusalem, he says in verse 16, "You have kept the statutes of Omri and all the works of the house of Ahab." These are two kings from the north. "You've walked in the counsels of the kings who've abandoned your God." And so he says, the influence from the north has come south, and it's leading you astray, walking in ways other than the ways of your God. What we need to see in this call to follow the proper leadership, a righteous leader who will establish justice, and those two have to go hand in hand. Without righteousness, there is no justice. Where there is unrighteousness, there's injustice. But when righteousness prevails, so too will justice. Righteousness always speaks of the vertical, being right in line with a standard that is divine. Justice always has the idea of the horizontal, of that blessing which comes down from God spreading out across the lands. So when you think righteousness, think along this axis. When you think justice, think along this axis, and you got it pretty much right. When this is removed, this can't flourish. And that's exactly what's happening both in the north and in the south. Contextually, we need to understand what role leadership plays within God's creation. Keep a paper or something here in the book of Micah, because it's hard to find once you lose it. But go back to Genesis. Genesis chapter 1. Oh man, we don't have to go back there. We know what it says. I know you know what it says. But I want you to see what it says again. Genesis chapter 1, verse 28. God made man. And in making man, he made man with a purpose. He made man for leadership. Leadership is simply the ability to influence that and those who are around them. Genesis 1, verse 28, God blessed man and woman, male and female, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the heavens, and over every living thing that moves on the earth." Influence it. Move it in a direction. Provide leadership. That's what I've made you for. And God places man having dominion, having power to exert and to shape everything inside his creation. Go over to Psalm chapter 8. Psalm chapter 8 is the psalmist rejoices in God's works. He said, "How majestic are your works." And then he talks about how he finds it amazing that in the midst of God's vast creation, that God would have any thought for tiny little man. He says in Psalm 8, verse 3, "When I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon, the stars that you've set in place, what is man that you think of him? The son of man, that you even care for him. Yet you made him a little lower than the heavenly beings. You crowned him with glory and honor, and you have given him dominion over the work of your hands. You've put all things under his feet." God has created man for leadership. The ability to influence those around him in a direction that would be right. Well, it's not always the way that man moves those around him. We see that, like nature itself, leadership abhors a vacuum. When there is no leader, it's never for very long. There will always be a leader. Whenever you take two kids, you put them in a room, they have to at some point decide to do the same thing. They won't always do opposite things. At some point, somebody's going to take the lead and they're going to say, "Hey, why don't we see how far we can stick this plunger down the toilet?" Or whatever it is that comes into their mind, somebody's going to take the lead and they're going to suggest to somebody around them, going to say, "Hey, let's do this." And that person takes the lead. What we see back in Genesis chapter 3, very early on in the story, man who's designed for leadership, is that Eve's sin is a failure in leadership. You see, Eve was designed to be led. She was designed to follow one who was her head, Adam. And instead of following her lead, she ends up leading the one that she was designed to follow, Adam. Great idea. This fruit, why don't you try it? Oh, hey, that's a good idea. And she takes the lead. Consequently, man who's designed, woman who's designed to lead in the ways of God, she's unable at this point to lead those who she's supposed to lead. She's following the leader that's been placed in front of her, Adam. She abdicates her following, takes the lead. And because of that, Abel, Cain ends up killing the one because she's lost her right. She's lost her ability to lead. Adam's sin is an abdication of leadership. He follows the one that he's designed to lead, and he chooses not to follow that he was the one that he's designed to follow. When, go back, Genesis chapter 3, verse 17. It's very interesting how God words this curse when talking to Adam. Genesis chapter 3, verse 17. "And to Adam he said, because you have listened to the voice of whom? You've listened to the voice of your wife, and you've eaten of the tree of which," what? "I commanded you not to eat." That is, you listened to the voice of your wife, and you refused to listen to the voice of me. You followed the one that you were supposed to lead, and you stopped following the one that you're supposed to follow. It's exactly a failure of leadership. We see Genesis 6, where the mighty men are battling over realms and territories, that we have a leadership vacuum. And those who are strongest, might makes right, and they're filling up that void. The book of Judges is the result of a leadership vacuum. At the end of the book of Judges, we see the very haunting phrase, "And every man did that which was right," what? "In his own eyes." Leadership abhors a vacuum. When somebody's not in front saying, "Hey, follow me as I follow Christ," somebody will step up and take the lead and say, "Hey, follow me while we do something other than following Christ." And that's been the story ever since. The times of the prophets is a result of a leadership vacuum. The time of the exile is the result of a leadership vacuum. In fact, the story of history, including present-day elections, is largely the result of a leadership vacuum. That's because since the fall, no leadership of man is good. No leadership of man is absolutely righteous. Remember how Psalm 14, Psalm 53 say it? They have all turned aside. Together they have become corrupt. There is none who does good. No, not even what? Not even one. Not even one. So how can God's blessing come down and spread out when we're not even keeping our eyes on the God who blesses? How can that spread throughout creation? How can that spread throughout my home? How can that spread in my marriage when I've taken my eyes off the source of that blessing? It can't. And so within creation, since the fall, no leadership of man is good. Romans picks up on the theme and reminds us that there's none that doeth good, no, not one, and it points us to Jesus. Isaiah picks up on this same theme, that there is none that does good. He develops it with a picture. Remember Isaiah, writing at the same time of Micah, says in chapter 53, verse 6, you probably know it, say it with me. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. And again, he points us to Christ, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. But none of us are qualified for leadership, because at some point, all of us are like sheep who wander our own paths, who wander our own ways, who do our own thing, that which is right in our own eyes. We lose sight of this, and consequently, all of this is affected. That's why it's always a dumb idea to just start at this level, on relationships level. I'm going to fix my relationship with this person without first taking care of my relationship in this direction. I don't have the capacity to fix this unless I'm giving attention to making sure that this is what it ought to be. And so we see that Isaiah picks up this theme and he puts it to a picture, the picture of a sheep who's turning different directions. The prophet Micah, writing at the same time of Isaiah, also picks up this same theme. In chapter 7, he says in verse 2, "The godly has perished from the earth. There is no one upright among all mankind." So now, because this is broken, look at chapter 7, verse 2, and see what's affected. Because the vertical is severed, it's snapped, it's broken, look at what the horizontal implications are. Middle of the verse. "Consequently now, they all lie in wait for blood. Each one hunts the other with a net." The vertical is broken. That means the horizontal is broken. And that's exactly where the book of Micah lands us as it's looking at this leadership vacuum. Both Isaiah and Micah find the solution to this leadership vacuum in a good shepherd. They both use shepherd imagery. Micah, coming from the fields of Judah, some 25 miles south and west of Jerusalem, a very agricultural society, a place where sheep were pastured. They both use this shepherd imagery to call Israel back to one who wants to be their shepherd. You're familiar with Isaiah chapter 40, verse 11. "He will tend his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs in his arms. He will carry them in his bosom and gently lead those who are with young." There's going to be a good shepherd someday who's going to come down. He's going to keep his eyes on the prize. For the joy that's set before him, he's going to endure the cross, despising the shame. One day he'll be seated at the right hand of the Father, the majesty on high. It's this one who keeps this in line at all times, who then is going to bring this, so that it spreads out as far as the curse is found. It's this one who's going to shepherd and tend and care and love compassionately. Micah says in chapter 5, verse 4, "He shall stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of his Lord, and they shall dwell secure, for he shall be great to the ends of the earth." Are you getting the picture? We need a righteous shepherd. We need a righteous leader. And when righteousness comes, then comes justice. And that's what Jesus Christ is forecast to do here in the book of Micah. In many of these books, Jesus Christ is not written in explicitly. He's implicitly the subject of the materials because he's the one by whom God will bring the restoration. But no book like Micah is so forward in presenting this righteous one who's coming to do the work of God on behalf of the people of God, in the program, establishing the program of God, to bring the peace, the shalom of God to the ends of the world. That's what this leader does. As we come to this book of Micah, what we're going to see is that he provides us three aspects of God's design in leadership. I'm going to run through these rather quickly this morning. But the first thing we need to see is that leadership is inevitable because it occurs naturally in every level of society. We've said already, leadership abhors a vacuum. Where somebody isn't taking the lead and saying, "Follow me as I follow Christ," somebody will take the lead to say, "Follow me." And whatever they want to fill in the blank is what they'll fill it in with. Leadership happens because we're people designed for leadership. And leadership happens in every level of society. It happens naturally. We could say supernaturally because we're designed in the image of God with the commission of God to lead, to influence the arena around us. I want us to go to the beginning of the book of Micah. We'll do kind of a quick walkthrough. Micah chapter 1, verse 1. "The word of the Lord that came to Micah of Moresheth," a location 25 miles south of Jerusalem, "in the days of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah," these 8th century kings, kings of Judah, "which he saw concerning Samaria in the north and Jerusalem in the south." He starts with the two capitals, the capital cities of north and south. Come down to verse 5. "All this is for the transgressions of Jacob, for the sins of the house of Israel." What is the transgression of Jacob? Is it not Samaria? Well, as the people of Judah are listening to this message from Micah, they're shaking their heads. Of course, yes, Samaria, the bad guys, where they have their golden calves. That is the transgression of Israel. You're right, Micah. Yeah, you give it to them. Oh, and what is the high place of Judah? Well, wait a minute, high place. What are you saying, like idol kind of stuff? Where does the idol worship happen for Judah? Where does he place that? Where does he locate that? Not Samaria, right in Jerusalem. And with stunning conciseness, he says, "Listen, Judah, your worship in the temple of Yahweh is no better than the worship of a golden calf up in Samaria." And he stings them right where they're located. He attacks their worship. And he begins in the city because the city is the greatest accumulation of people. From Jerusalem, so goes the entire region of Judah. From Samaria, so goes the entire region of Israel. Where you have the people clusters, you have the leadership of the rest of the peoples. You have more people going the same direction. You see that in our own nation, where you have more people coming together, deciding what to do. They're pulling others in their wake. It's what happened in Babylon. Hey, let's build a tower to the heavens and make a name for ourselves. That's a great idea. And they all come together to do it. And God says, "No, you don't." And he spreads them all out. They're taking the leadership and moving in a direction opposite God, hoping to become gods. And God crushes that rebellion. Micah focuses on the city, and he hints at failures in the king. He says, verse 8, "For this I will lament, wail, I'll go stripped and naked. I'll make lamentation like the jackals and mourning like the ostriches, because her wound is incurable." That is, Israel's in the north. "And her wound has come down to Judah. It's reached to the very gate of my people right here in Jerusalem." And then he says in verse 10, "Tell it not in Gath." And we wouldn't recognize this necessarily as a reference to any place else in Scripture, but this goes back to 2 Samuel chapter 1, verse 20, where David is lamenting the death of another leader in Israel, the death of Saul, the very first king, the very first king who lost sight of this and consequently lost hold of this. That's why when Goliath comes on the scene, it's not primarily the story of David and Goliath, it's a story about Saul and Goliath. Saul, who's the leader of God's people, can't bring, he's incapable of bringing justice, shalom, peace at this level because he's lost hold of his God. David comes on the scene to do that for him. Okay? He hints at the failure of the king, in fact, is developed a little bit further in chapter 4, verse 9, where Micah says, "Why do you cry? Is there no king in you? Has your counselor perished that pain seizes you like a woman in labor? Where's your king? Where's your leader? Where's the one who calls you to follow him as he follows God?" Oh, he's abdicated that privilege. He's abdicated that responsibility. He emphasizes in chapter 3, verse 1, the failure of the ruling class. He says in 3, "Hear, you heads of Jacob, you rulers of the house of Israel. Is it not for you as rulers to know justice? To know how this righteousness is supposed to play out on the horizontal level? Is it not for you who hate the good and love the evil?" Listen, you're supposed to love good and hate evil. You've turned it all upside down. And because of that, what you're supposed to bring for your people, you can't, because you don't even know what is good. He focuses on the failure in this section, verse 5, of the prophets. "Thus," excuse me, "thus says the Lord concerning the prophets, who do what? Who lead my people astray. They cry peace when they have something to eat, but they declare war against him who puts nothing in their mouths." Whoa, sounds like a 2020 election, doesn't it? Hey, we're for somebody who puts something in my mouth. If you don't give me something, then you're not my person. You're not my candidate. That's exactly the message that these prophets are preaching. That's why the ministry of Micah stands out, verse 8, "But as for me, I'm filled with power, with the Spirit of the Lord, with justice, and with might, because it's my job to tell them that they're not righteous. I will bring justice by telling them they're not righteous. That's what I have to tell. That's why my ministry is different." In chapter 3, verse 11, he speaks not only of the heads, the rulers, the prophets, but of the priests. But all of them, you'll note, kind of like Amos, the heads give judgment for a bribe. The priests teach for a price. The prophets practice for money. It's all about themselves. Chapter 6, verse 11. This leadership failure, this leadership vacuum, it's happening in a political level. It's happening for those who are ruling, for those in the religious arena, the prophets, the priests. It's happening in the economic level. Chapter 6, verse 11. "Shall I acquit the man with wicked scales, with a bag of deceitful weights?" Justice isn't happening in the marketplace because every man is looking out for his own good. He's putting his thumb on the scale. He's tipping the weight, charging excess, giving them less, charging them more. There's a failure in the merchants. There's a failure in verse 12 from the wealthy. "You're rich men. They're rich because of their violence. They're full of violence. Your common inhabitants speak lies." This leadership lack has infiltrated every level of society. In fact, one of the most sad verses in all of the book of Micah is found back in chapter 1, verse 16. He lists several cities that are going to be targeted, and he uses a pun on their name to help them understand their destructive end. And he goes through city by city by city, and he says, "You who have this name, you will experience this reality. You who have this name will experience this bad reality as a result of the judgment of God." And after naming city after city that will suffer God's judgment, he comes down to verse 16 and he says this, "Make yourselves bald. Cut off your hair, because the children of your delight, make yourselves as bald as an eagle, for those children will go away from you into exile." You've paved the way for your own defeat, and you know who's going to pay for it? You've let go of righteousness, and you know who's going to pay for it? It's your children. It's your children. The rulers, the priests, the prophets, the merchants, the wealthy, the parents. The parents are caught up in the flood of selfishness. They've refused, they've abdicated the responsibility of saying, "As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." They've abdicated leadership. Leadership is inevitable because it occurs naturally at every level of society. And if, friend, if father, husband, if you are not saying to your wife, "Follow me as I follow Christ," then you're forcing her to take a lead that she wasn't designed to take. You're frustrated sometimes that your wife is more spiritually attuned, more spiritually acute than you, husband? Whose fault is that? It's not hers. It's yours. Mom, are you concerned that your children aren't following you? Maybe if they had a little better vision of what that was supposed to look like, they would be able to follow a little more clearly. Leadership is inevitable because it occurs naturally in every level of society. Secondly, leadership since the fall is difficult because man naturally looks out for himself. Go to chapter 3, verse 1. We looked at this already. "Hear, you heads of Jacob, rulers of the house of Israel, is it not for you to know justice? You who hate the good and love the evil?" And then he gives a little further description of what they look like. "Rather than shepherds, they've become butchers. You who tear the skin from off my people. You who tear their flesh from off their bones. You who eat the flesh of my people and flay their skin from off of them and break their bones in pieces and chop them up like meat in a pot, like flesh in a cauldron." Man, that's a little tough. It's a little graphic there, Micah, don't you think? I mean, we got kids in the audience. Listen, don't you understand? "Rather than being shepherds and caretakers and tenders and providers and caregivers for God, you've become those who take advantage of those that you're supposed to be taking care of. You're making sure that they meet your needs, your desires. They're serving you rather than you serving them." Ezekiel chapter 34 gives the same picture of shepherds who are eating up the flock that God has commissioned them to give their lives in service to. But not only have the shepherds become butchers, but the inheritors of leadership have become grabbers of inheritance. Go back to chapter 2, verse 1. "Woe to those who devise wickedness and work evil in their beds, and when the morning dawns, they perform this evil, because it's in their power and the power of their hand. They covet fields, so they seize them. They covet houses, so they take them. They oppress a man and his house, a man and his entire inheritance." And there's some who believe that this is a reference specifically to Ahab, who stole the vineyard of Nabal. On his bed, deciding, "This is what I want." And Jezebel says, "Honey, I'll get it for you. Let's just make him dead, and then we get the goods." Since the fall, leadership is difficult because man naturally looks out for himself. And we would say amen, right? I mean, you look in politics, you look at the ballot, and you say, who do I vote for? They're all in it for themselves. But the invitation of Micah isn't to look at the ballot. The invitation of Micah is to look in the mirror. Okay? You were designed for leadership. And since the fall, you struggle with doing leadership well. Because you now are driven by a lust, by a thirst for self-advancement rather than service for others. Well, what's the solution? The only solution that's available. We tend to look at people as meat, as opportunities to pad ourselves. But what we see is that leadership is powerful because it satisfies our need to follow. You see, even Adam, commissioned with leadership from the very beginning over all of creation, even over his wife, Adam was designed to follow God. Adam, why did you follow the voice of your wife rather than following my voice? Leader, why didn't you follow? That's always the question. Because we're designed to follow. We're designed to follow. But we don't follow well. We need somebody who does. And so in the book of Micah, he says, listen, while you have abdicated leadership, I'm sending a leader. Chapter 2, he's announcing judgment, but at the end of the announcement of judgment, verse 12, he says, I will surely assemble all of you, Jacob. I'm going to gather the remnant of my people. I'll set them together like sheep in a fold, like a flock in its pasture, a noisy multitude of men. Then he who opens the breach will go up before them. He's been talking about how they will be taken out of their land into a place of exile. But in their exile, they'll come back to their land. And there's one who's going to go before them, who's going to open the breach. He's going to create a way, and he's going to create a path forward. He's speaking of a new exodus. It's exactly what Moses and Elijah are talking to Jesus about on the Mount of Transfiguration as he's preparing for going to Jerusalem, preparing for his death. And it talks about in Hebrews chapter 2, verses 14 and 15, how he endured death so that those who were all of their lives subject to slavery because of death might find freedom, exodus in him. He who opens the breach goes up before them. They break through and pass the gate. They go out by it, and their king passes on before them. Their king is the Lord. And as you're looking at this, you're not quite understanding. Is this God or is this a man? And the answer is yes, in the person and work of Jesus Christ. And so we come up to chapter 4. And we read it already, in the latter days the mountains of this house are going to be established as the highest of mountains. Many peoples will flow to it. The nations will come and say, let's go to the house of the Lord, verse 3, and the Lord will judge many peoples. Wait a minute, are we talking about a man or God? The answer is yes, the God-man. We come to chapter 5. He's talking about verse 1. Them striking the judge of Israel, that's striking the king of Israel. He's talking about the physical king on the throne at that time. When the Assyrians come in, when the Babylonians come in, they will strike the judge, the leader, the ruler of Israel. And then he turns, and he looks many centuries down ahead, and he says, but you, Bethlehem of Ephratah, you're small, but I've made a promise to a king who was a man after my own heart, one who loved righteousness and brought justice. And I'm going to have a new king that I promised to the line of David, who's going to be born in the city of David. He will be a king like the son of David, and he will come and shepherd my people. Verse 2, from you shall come forth for me, one who is to be ruler in Israel, whose coming forth was from ancient of days. I've had this in the works for so very long. That's why when Matthew comes on the scene and he's presenting the king and he gives all of the background of the line, the genealogy of the king, he cites this Micah passage on purpose. He's got this big picture. Herod asks, where's the king to be born? Well, everybody knows that. It's the place where the son of David is supposed to be born. Bethlehem, David's hometown. That's where it's coming. But look at how the rest of this shapes out. Chapter 5, verse 3. He shall give them up until that time when she who is in labor gives birth. But then the rest of his brothers will return to the people of Israel, and he shall stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of his name, of the Lord his God. And they will dwell secure, and he will be great, all the way to the ends of the earth. He will shepherd in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. He is keeping very tight hold of this righteous axis that he might bring justice to the ends of the world. I love how verse 5, the beginning of it, ends this passage, says, and he will be their peace. It doesn't say that he will give them peace. It says he will be their peace. We are designed to follow. And so God has given us his Son, who follows perfectly and calls us to follow with him. Let's go to chapter 7. Verse 14 is the last messianic passage. Shepherd your people with your staff, the flock of your inheritance, who dwell alone in the forest, in the midst of a garden land. Let them graze in the lush places, Bashan, Gilead, like they did in the days of old, as in the days when they came out of Egypt. I will show them marvelous things, things that will make them marvel, things that they will think wonderful. And he talks about how those who have oppressed will be oppressed by God. But look at verse 18. Understand what's happening here. The name Micah means, who is like God? Come to verse 18, and that's the question that's asked. Who is a God like you? God, you designed us for leadership, and we abdicated that responsibility. You called us to follow, and we failed to follow. You designed us to call others to follow, and we failed to do that. God, is there any hope for us? Oh God, who's a God like you who can pardon our iniquities? Who's a God like you who can pass over our transgressions? Who's a God like you who does not retain his anger forever, but instead delights in steadfast love? Who's a God like you who will again have compassion on us? Who is a God like you who will tread our iniquities underfoot? Who is a God like you who will cast all our sins into the depths of the sea? Who is a God like you who will show faithfulness to Jacob? Who is a God like you who will show steadfast love as you've promised to your servant? What kind of a God are you, God, that you would care about us when we shook our fist at you, when we severed the relationship with you? God says, you're right, there's no God like me. And I'm going to give a leader that nobody else is like, who will bring my people home. Dad, you struggle being a leader? Mom, you struggle being a leader? Older brother, you struggle being a leader? Christian, you struggle being a leader? Guess what? It's tough. Since the fall, it's tough. But you were designed for leadership, and you can only do that leading as you follow the one who leads you home. And so, the invitation of Micah is this: learn to follow the one who, because of his great love both for God and for you, will never lead you astray. You know, you still have a commission. You still are designed to influence others to God. You're still designed to be holy because he's holy. But you can't do it in yourself. You can't do it unless you learn to follow. And you've got to follow the one who leads you home. Let's pray.